minutes. We're ready? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll call the meeting back to order, and we have a presentation on Hemlock Woolly Aldegid. Jeffrey Ogden, Provincial Forest Entomologist. Alex, I do have this.
Entomologist.
Okay.
Okay.
Entomologist.
I'll see if I can share. Should be able to share. I can see you guys now. Can you see me?
No. There we are.
Okay. But in presentation mode. On Numby. It's in presentation mode?
Yeah. Yep, looks good.
Okay. Now I need to find my notes. I don't know where the heck they went. You still see presentation mode?
Yes.
Okay, I'll cheat and go to the other page here. Well, thank you very much for having us today. My name is Jeff Ogden. I am with the Department of Natural Resources and Renewables. We also have on the line Dan Levine. He is my manager. I'm going to set a timer to go because both of us tend to be long-winded. So if I don't put a timer on there, we'll go over our 10-minute allotted time. So, we're talking about Hemlock Woolly Aldegid, and what we wanted to do was just, we're not sure how many people know about Hemlock Woolly Aldegid. It was suggested that we speak to the council, just to give you an update of what's going on, what the province is currently doing, what our other partners are currently doing. As soon as I start to talk, I start to gag. Excuse me. And this is a provincial update, and I will be doing the bulk of the talking, but it takes a lot of people to actually do the research, do the work. We are part of a Nova Scotia Hemlock Woolly Aldegid Management Group. It's made up of not just provincial representatives, but federal representatives from Canadian Forestry Service, Parks Canada, Mi'kmaq groups, communities, if we can get them involved, Medway Forest Co-op, a whole host of people are actually part of the work that we're doing to manage for Hemlock Woolly Aldegid. Now, okay. Did slides advance? There we go. Slides advance. On my side, did they advance on yours?
Yes, they did.
Okay, good. We're working. An introduction to the pest itself. It's a tiny little aphid-like insect. It feeds at the base of the needles of the hemlock trees, and although it's tiny, it occurs by the billions. And their damage, it breaks down the structures at the base of the needle. It doesn't allow for transfer of fluids and material from the needles into the needles, what have you, back and forth. And the needles eventually die. The tips, the new branches eventually die. They cease to produce new growth. And when you stop producing new growth, you're eventually going to pass away. In these images, we have a small little nymph that's feeding. It says less than 3 millimeters, feeding at the base. As they grow, they produce this wool. And the wool is the most noticeable part of the Hemlock Woolly Aldegid. This is what you're going to see when you're looking under your branches. You're not going to see the tiny little nymphs that don't have the wool produced yet, unless you have hand lens or really good eyes. But you will see this wool, which is in the third picture. And when populations are heavy, it's very evident. And it's evident all year round. Initially, when we first started to work on this, we were led to believe that, well, it's only there for a short period of time. You have to check your branches at, you know, winter time, that's when it's most active. But we find in Nova Scotia that the wool, even just fractions of it or bits and gobs of it, will remain on the branches throughout the year. So you can be monitoring for this pest 12 months of the year. The other picture back here is an adult laying eggs. And as I say adult female, the whole population is females. That's why the population can grow so quickly. They do not need to have sexual activity to reproduce. It's all parthenogenic. One female can produce thousands of eggs over a lifetime. And that's, they can occur not only at one or two at the base of needles, but I've seen as many as four adelgids feeding at the base of the needles at one time. Oop. Sorry. Complicated part and complex. I don't want to say complicated. They have a complex life cycle where there's two generations a year. So there's an overwintering generation that's just waking up now and will feed all winter. That's prime time when they're feeding. It's this time of year. And then in the spring, they'll produce another generation. So even if we have winter kill, if there's cold temperatures below minus 20, that will impact the population. But the summer generation will more than make up for any loss in the overwintering population. So this two-generation system complicates things, it makes it complex, but it also really helps the adelgid continue the population growth.
I'll just stop you for 1 second. Mayor Balaragetson, you have a question?
Yes, I'm looking at your chart here, and I'm seeing from the egg stage up to the adult, I guess, stage, then back to the egg stage, but then you have these crawlers.
The crawlers are it's the first generation. So for each life stage, it's called an instar. And so when it hatches, the first instar, there's a crawling stage, which is the only time that this insect moves. So once it hatches, it crawls around, finds a suitable place to establish, which is at the base of a needle. And then once it establishes, it inserts its mouth part, which is a tiny little tube-like thing called a stylet that actually comes out of its belly. It inserts that into the stem of the tree. Once it is established, if it's removed, it dies. So the crawlers are a very important stage. That is the only stage it can actually move around.
There is a crawler stage from the mid-April eggs as well, correct?
Correct. The overwintering ones will be, they'll be laying their eggs. It's about mid-April here in Nova Scotia, and they lay their eggs right until June or July. And as those hatch, the crawlers emerge.
Okay. I was only seeing the crawlers in the first generation, but that happens in the next generation with the mid-July. It happens in mid-April as well.
Mid-April as well, yeah. Sorry, okay. That's... I would like to say I made this and complained to myself, but I stole this from somebody, a buddy of mine. So, so yes, there are two crawler stages. So there are two periods of the year. Well, it's an extended period from mid-April right up until August where there's crawlers in the environment from one or the other, or in some cases, both generations. And that is the period of time where the greatest risk of spreading hemlock-woolly adelgid occurs. Well, it's the only real time. Because if you move branches this time of year or a tree this time of year and you take it to someplace else, the adelgid that are on there are not going to survive the winter from a dead tree. And they can't jump off and move to another tree that's living because once they're established, they can no longer move. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. That's no... I was going to wait to see nodding, but there's no way I can see you. Your picture's too small. So why is this a threat? Well, it's a non-native species. Not all non-native species are a huge threat. There's thousands of insect species in Nova Scotia that they're not from here, but they're benign. They're just in the background noise. They don't do anything. They may displace a species here or there, but do they actually cause damage to trees, for example, or impact other species? No. But in this case, they do. This is a species that is a threat. It has zero natural enemies in Nova Scotia. We've done, I say we, it's a collaborative effort with Canadian Forestry Service. It was their project. We were looking for natural enemies within the province that would feed on them that may keep their numbers down. We found very few. There's ladybird beetles. Not those Asian ones that people see thousands of them on the houses. They don't seem to have any impact on the adelgid, which is unfortunate. Good reason to have them. But a few lacewings and a few other predators, but nothing at a level that would have any impact on this species. It spreads rapidly. It is spread, we believe it got here, by either wind and or combination with birds. because the crawlers during that crawling period are up in the canopy, the birds are feeding on whatever's there, and they will crawl on a bird, get into the feathers, and move from place to place. They can survive in that crawler stage for several days without being attached to a tree or without feeding on a tree, as long as they don't dry out. So on the belly of a warm belly of a bird, they're not going to dry out. If they're on a branch on the back of a truck blowing around, the chances are they're going to spread, but they may also dry out. So they need the dampness to survive. They can kill a hemlock within 10 to 14 years. I've seen trees that are perfectly healthy begin to decline easily within those 4 years. They stop producing new growth.
I'm just going to clarify something here. It can kill a hemlock from 4 to 10 years or 10 to 14?
Within 4 to 10 years. It'll start to decline after 4 years of infestation. If it's a smaller tree, it could die.
Thank you.
Larger trees, more needles, takes a little bit longer to knock it back. But it's in Nova Scotia, it's between 4 and 10 years.
Thanks.
Yeah. And it's very difficult to control. In the past, if it was a herbivore feeding on our trees, we could use an aerial protection program to spray BT on it and knock it back. You can't do that in this case. You can't do broad scale treatment in that respect. You can't you can do things like opening up the canopy to reduce the numbers, but you're never really going to eliminate the pest. Cold temperatures don't seem to have they have an impact. Let's take that back. They do have an impact. If we get minus 20 degrees, even for a single day, the population will be severely impacted. 85 to close to 100% knockdown. But as I mentioned earlier, they're all females, and it only takes one. And by mid-July, that population that could have been decimated in March or in February is back up to pre-winter population levels. Any questions at that point?
Yes, no. Councillor DeLong.
Thank you. Yes, if you're going to be speaking to this later in your presentation, please disregard, but will you be speaking to the ecosystem benefits and how important hemlocks are as a carbon sink?
Right now. Good timing. This should be labeled, well, it is, distribution of hemlock. And the importance of hemlock on the landscape. Carbon sink, yes, big tree. I know very little about the carbon aspect. Dan may pipe up on this. For me, it was an ecosystem changer. I've been working with forest pest insects for 30 years now. And this was the only one that really scared the crap out of me. Because it's changing an ecosystem that's been there for hundreds, if not thousands of years, millennia. And once you take that ecosystem away, it's going to be a long time before it can be replaced. I see Dan's hand up.
Yeah,
you don't need your hand up with me. You're my boss.
Go ahead, Dan.
Good morning, Mayor, and good morning, Council. Thanks for having Jeff and I provide this information to you this morning. I just wanted to make a comment that our department has done a risk analysis, and from that risk analysis, what we found that there is a high risk severity that's caused by this pest when it comes to ecosystems, the ecological benefits that hemlock provides in the province. You know, obviously, there's a big amount of carbon that's stored in these older forests, hemlock forests, and so losing that carbon obviously can have an impact on things like climate change in the future. You know, these forests provide, you know, they provide homes for a variety of different species. You know, they also help to regulate stream flow. You know, it basically it kind of slows down the amount of water that kind of ends up in streams and in inner rivers, and helps to stabilize banks and the banks along those rivers. So basically, if we were to lose a lot of the hemlock along those riparian areas, that could have consequences in the future as well, in terms of, you know, more stream flow, maybe damaged infrastructure, some flooding. So, I mean, the other thing is that these stands are of cultural significance to the Mi'kmaq as well. You know, we have old growth forest areas, we have protected areas, and wildland areas in the province that obviously would be impacted by this insect as well. So I just wanted to make that comment, Jeff, just to add kind of to the discussion this morning.
I think that was answering the question from the counselor.
Yes.
Perfect.
You can go ahead.
Dan summed that one up light nicely. Where am I? Just a second. So currently, I'm just going to give you a current status of where we are. There's a delay. I'm impatient. I pushed the button twice, and then it moves ahead to two slides. So I apologize for that. Stop for the impatience. We do annual aerial surveys across the province, and in particular in the western end, looking for the extent of damage that we can detect from the hemlock woolly adelgid. And since 2018, we've mapped over 75,000 hectares of moderate to severe impact forest. I've mentioned this, well, not to you guys, but several people. That's 75,000 hectares that we can detect. When you're on the ground, well, from the air, you're not going to detect light to just getting into moderate damage in hemlock woolly adelgid. The trees look fine. They look green from the air. They're not showing any gray. They're not showing any loss of foliage. So we can't detect all that from the air. So that 75,000 hectares just scratches the surface of the forest, the amount of forest that's actually being impacted by hemlock woolly adelgid in the western part of the province. Then the picture here is a picture near Sissaboo Falls that we've been following that since it started. And the picture doesn't really do it justice. These trees are declining extremely fast. They went from lovely green trees to now these are gray ghosts, they call them, just standing there dead. Again, Dan, if you have anything to add, for please. We're currently, the province applied for federal funding through the Department of Climate Change, Department of Environment and Climate Change Canada, and they were successful. This, again, was a group effort through DNR and Environment and Climate Change, the province group. We were able to get $5 million for land conservation, and that is to purchase properties to protect the hemlock that are on that stand for carbon storage and carbon storage forever. That's the idea of that. Those lands will be converted from whatever they are now to protected, and it's primarily for climate change and carbon storage. The other $5 million is to protect through chemical control program. We are doing a fraction. It's we only have 5 years, so we're doing approximately 1,500 hectares. It is all on protected crown land at this point. For the duration of the program, that's where that program is going to be undertaken. Will be, as you can see in the photos, there's two different types of treatments that we are doing. One is basal bark spray and the other one is tree injection. And more recently, that money also goes towards research of biocontrol, the releasing of biocontrol agents, in this case it's beetles and some flies, that have been worked on for over 40 years. That only feed on adelgid, because that will be the first question, is what else they feed on. Do they feed on butterflies? Do they feed on caterpillars? These things only feed on adelgid. Now, it can be hemlock woolly adelgid, balsam woolly adelgid, which is another invasive species that was introduced over 100 years ago that feeds on our balsam fir trees, and white pine woolly adelgid, which is a native species, but it feeds on the white pine.
We have a question. I'll just stop you there for a second. Councillor Moore? Yep.
Thank you. I'm the one that put this on the agenda for a presentation through the recommendation of Tom Rogers, which is a resident of my district. I also was able to watch, I don't know if you're familiar, you probably am, on the CBC, in The Quiet in the Dark, the documentation that was made by Sally Steele and Donna Crosland. I know both of those people. Donna grew up in my area, and Sally Steele used to work for the waste site here. It's a very informative documentary that I will be passing on to the council for to look at. The injections, the tree injections within that documentary seem to be working. The chemicals seem to be working. I was trying to get a handle on it because I know it's kind of started the research in Ketchum Coochie through Donna Crosland. I think a lot of the kickback was because of the chemical use. Am I correct with that?
Chemical, yes. No, I will correct you. The bulk of the research on the chemicals is through the Canadian Forestry Service scientists out of Fredericton. They're the ones conducting the research. Okay. We're benefiting from their research.
Okay.
And they've been at this for a number of years. We are seeing positive results with both the basal bark spray and the stem injections, but it is in the beginning. So we're just starting, it's only been a couple of years, the plan is to follow these trees through over the next, 4 to 5 years, even longer, and follow these stands through. Mm-hmm. So they are showing positive results. Hard stop.
Okay.
The chemical issue, there's also a scientist called Dr. Chris Edge. He's working on impacts on non-target species. So that research is also ongoing.
My question is, are you getting pushback? Because it seems like the chemicals will work over time. Are you getting pushback on using those chemicals?
Not as much as you'd think.
Okay, good.
I really don't have personally, I haven't had any calls or people complaining or a lot of concerns because the research has been done for over the last 40 years. Yeah. There's a lot of work that's gone into this.
Yeah.
The researchers in Fredericton, again, are extremely good at what they do. And we're getting out in front of it. If we were just springing it on people, we're going to spray chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
People may be concerned about that. But we are getting out in front of this, explaining to people the importance of these hemlock trees and these hemlock stands. In explaining people the impacts or the non-impacts that we're seeing. And then when you have to weigh between the little bit of chemical that's going to be in the environment versus the total loss of those trees.
Exactly.
If you don't have those forests, what are you going to lose?
Yeah.
Versus what you possibly could lose or potentially lose as a result of these chemical treatments.
Exactly. Thank you. I was just wondering if you do get pushback because of the chemical. It seemed like the chemical was explained in documentary that it just basically goes after the woolly elegrit, whatever it's called, and doesn't
HWA. Really, it's easier to say.
Right. And doesn't and doesn't harm other species or anything like that. So that's good to know. Thank you.
Dan, did you have something you wanted to add there?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that any of the chemicals that we are using, the chemical pesticides that we are using, have been approved by Health Canada, by their pest management regulatory agency. So they are safe for use when they're used according to the label directions. And I just wanted to add that these are systemic insecticides. So basically, whether they're injected into the tree or they're sprayed onto the bark of the tree, they're absorbed into the tree and they're taken through the vascular system of the tree up into the crown where the adelgids are feeding. And will there be impacts to other non-targets? I mean, some of the studies that have been done elsewhere, there are some short-term impacts. You know, some of your soil invertebrates, some of your canopy arthropods may be impacted in the short term, but the overall impact, as Jeff mentioned, you might get these short-term impacts, but those populations tend to rebound again. But losing the hemlock would be a far greater impact than the some of the non-target impacts, that short-term impacts that you do see.
Definitely. Mayor Bulla-Ragetson, you have something to add?
My pen is falling apart. Yes. I guess I'm looking at this, and I recently attended the Truth and Reconciliation Day that was held here, and they were speaking about Windhorse Farm, or what was formerly known as Windhorse Farm. I'm not sure if it still retains that name or not. What is it?
Azidulik is the name.
Yes, okay. So they were saying about having volunteers that were out injecting these trees and doing this, and I guess we own woodland. I know how, I guess, much time it would take to inject individual trees in the method that I see in that last slide happening here. Is there an aerial spray, or is it something that you just can't do to treat the hemlock? And yes, hemlocks is that wood that were used in boat building, was used in barn construction, was used in whatever. It's that hemlock was the go-to for a lot of construction, and yes, for generations.
There is no application. It's a tree-by-tree basis. It is slow. It is slow.
And I guess success rate, I guess, how long does it take for this to take over a tree? Like, what's your timeline to be able to actually treat it once it's infested?
Well, that varies on the tree, and then we'll get into the chemical and how long it takes to get up. But that does vary on the tree. I mentioned that trees can show decline after 4 years, and some can see mortality. It can be dead after 4 years. But there is a window. If the tree still has some new growth on it, we can treat it with a product that takes a little longer to get up there, but then it'll control the adelgia for up to 4 to 7 years. If the tree seems to be a little bit in decline, no new growth, but the canopy's still green, for example, we can still treat that. There has been research done in the States where those trees will come back. They come back slowly, but you have to get the pesticide in there, and it has to be taken up quickly. And that's, we have another product called Starkle. It's a dinotefuran chemical. It gets in the tree within weeks, quickly goes up into the tree and kills the adelgia that are currently feeding on it. But it only lasts up to maybe 2 years, so you'd have to treat it with the Zytec or the other product, which lasts longer. But yes, there is a window. It's not just, oh, the tree has it, it's hooped. You do have time to get in there, find the trees, and treat them. But
so I guess success rate, when you look at how many people would it actually take to treat our infested forest today?
All of it?
And I see a $5 million, is that what I'm seeing here for? And is that adequate to do what needs to be done?
No. Long and short, but Dan will chime in. But no, it is not. We're at $5 million to treat 1,500 hectares. The plan is to keep hemlock on the landscape because it's a protected. Oh, I hear voices.
You've got 216,000 hectares of forest that's in the province that contains hemlock. So 1,500 hectares, being able to treat 1,500 hectares is a very small portion of that, obviously. And that's why, obviously, we're continuing the research looking at biocontrol, because if these predators can be introduced and what they're doing on the West Coast right now, these predators are actually present on the West Coast, where HWA is also present, and they basically regulate populations on the West Coast, so that you don't see the decline in the mortality that we're seeing here in Eastern Canada. So I guess the other thing that I was going to mention, our recommendation is not to wait too long. If you find hemlock in areas where, if you find hemlock woolly dug in areas where you have hemlock, it's better probably to go in and treat earlier than to wait till later. And the reason is the trees are still in good enough condition that they're healthy. They can take up the product into the crown. Even if it takes 6 to 9 months to get the product up into the crown, those trees are still in good enough shape that they, you know, they're not going to suffer during that period of time. If you wait longer, it's much harder sometimes to, you know, treat them and maybe have success. So if you are my recommendation would be, if you start to find HWA in stands where you have hemlock, then it would be better to treat them early rather than later.
So, Dan, just secondary to that, or supplementary to that, we're talking about crown land only, correct? And we have 60-70% of our woodland that is privately owned, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So knowing that fact, that definitely is putting, and a lot of landowners would not even know this.
Well, I guess part of the $5 million that we are getting, we are using it for treatments. We're using it to advance some of the research around biocontrol, but we're also using it for outreach as well. So we do have field days. We do provide information to private landowners so that they're aware of what products are registered for use. And Jeff will provide some information on that here later on. But, and sort of talking to them about how they can treat hemlocks on their own private lands, or there are people that are out there that are private applicators that can do the treatments for them.
Councillor Oikos, you have a question? You've been patiently waiting.
Yep. No, it isn't a question. I was just was planning to mention what Mayor Bolivar Getson mentioned, that the Washoeobah First Nations at their present location that they have at the Windhorse Farm have up on their website dates, and they're doing it this week. It's all volunteer based. They also have it in a week in November as well, rain or shine. So you're able to sign up and help and support them to be able to get and inoculate basically all their trees on that farm. I just wanted to mention that to council.
Councillor DeLong.
Thank you. I just want to flag that we do have a very fine hemlock stand in River Ridge Commons in the Hemlock Hollow Trail. And I'm really grateful to my colleague for bringing up in the quiet and the dark the documentary that was actually screened at the South Shore Sustainability Summit as well. So it is excellent. Yeah. The main proponent in that documentary, Donna Crosland, is optimistic that we'll be able to save some, but I think she said in the order of like 1%. It's very, very distressing. And just as Councillor Oikle was mentioning, the Aussie Dulisk, formerly Windhorse, they have somewhere upwards of 30,000 hemlocks that are growing there that are being inoculated by volunteers. It's fantastic. Thank you.
It is fantastic. We have a question from Councillor Haysom, and then we'll continue with the presentation.
Thank you so much. Along those lines of inoculation, is there going to be an opportunity ever for the sort of average woodlot owner to be able to do some sort of inoculation on their own property? So, you know, if we say that preventative medicine is the best, maybe you have some hemlocks on your property, are you able, is that a possibility? Is that something that we could, you know, advocate for funding for from the province or the feds to try and address that problem proactively?
You want to tackle the funding part, Dan?
So I guess what Jeff does have a slide later on in the presentation, and I just wanted to mention that the work that they're doing is at Azidulik is fantastic and making use of volunteers. But I just want to mention that the product that they're using is called Imajet. That's the product that's actually being injected into the trees. To treat a 40 centimeter tree, you're looking at a cost of around $13 per tree. to do basal applications of either Zytec 2F or the Starkle 20SG, you're looking at probably a cost of around $350 to $375 for just the product alone per tree. So I'm not even talking about the labor that's involved in doing the treatments. But it is costly to do these chemical treatments. I mean, you're going from one tree to the next. And in our conversations with private woodlot owners, with folks that have hemlock on their properties, you know, some of them are willing to go out and get their pesticide applicator certificate because these are commercial pesticides. They're not something that you can go and buy at a Canadian Tire or your hardware store. You have to order them from the supplier, and you have to have a commercial pesticide applicator's certificate to apply them. But some of them are willing to do that. They're willing to purchase the product and actually go out and treat their trees. And like I'd mentioned before, there are private applicators out there for hire as well that will do this kind of work.
Thank you. Okay, Jeffrey, you can continue.
Okay, well, all that talk of the pesticides, that works. But that's for a short term, or you have to continue to treat these trees every 5 to 7 years. The long-term goal is for biocontrol. Release these animals and have them control the adelgid for us. They're never going to get rid of the adelgid, but between winter kill and their predatory action, it should keep the adelgid down to a dollar or. In the Western Canada, populations of adelgid are in certain areas are just as high as they are here, but they're not seeing any damage because of these biocontrol agents that are already established there. They've evolved with the adelgid, and the populations of adelgid go up a little bit, the beetles come in, knock them back down, and they're not seeing any damage on their hemlock trees. So the plan is, the research has been going on for the last couple of years. First, we did the, are there any predators out there? Are there anything that can help us in Nova Scotia? There wasn't. We deemed that there wasn't enough. So we needed to introduce something. So the researchers with CFS are actually going to be heading out west right away and be collecting these beetles for the first round of releases as early as next week, 2 weeks from now. In sites, one of them is actually Kedgeree National Park, and in a couple other sites in the western part of the province, to see if they survive. That is a question. They should survive. The temperatures are fine. The conditions are perfect for them, adelgid population wise. But minus 20 will knock them back as well as knock back the hemlock woolly adelgid. So the research has begun. The releases will be this fall. The plan is you don't want to just release one predator. I think I mentioned earlier that winter will knock them back, but the summer generation will bring the population right back up. So what we would like to do, and the plan is, to release the beetles, the Nigrinus, in the fall. That will help knock down the overwintering populations. And then establish a rearing facility here in Nova Scotia where we can bring back foliage with these other predators on them. They're called silver flies, like a gray-looking housefly. We have to keep this in the containment area because we are bringing back foliage from out west. We don't want to introduce anything nasty to our forest. So in these containment areas, the flies will be reared, and then the cleaned flies will then be released on the summer populations, therefore keeping, you know, an impact on this overwintering population. And as it starts to rebound, hit it with the flies, and that'll keep the population down again to a dull roar. There is also another beetle. It's from Japan, but it has been established in northeastern United States for the last number of years, which is a voracious little feeder too, and that would also be released in the fall. Not sure on that one exactly.
Mayor Bellabergetson, you have a question?
Sounds like I swallowed the fly to catch the going through this. And I'm looking at this beetle, and I guess does this beetle that we're going to bring from the West Coast to the East Coast have any side effects that we need to be aware of as a species as well? I'm looking at this thing, and it doesn't look that attractive to me, but I guess if it controls this, that's great. But
it's not very big. No, actually,
it looks big when I looked it up.
Oh, no, they're tiny. They're quite tiny. And here's an image of how they're released and their impact on which population. They're very species specific.
Okay.
Both the beetles, both species of beetles, and both species of these silverflies are very species specific. I think I mentioned this earlier, where they only feed on adelgid. They will feed on hemlock woolly adelgid, and yet another introduced adelgid called the balsam woolly adelgid, balsam woolly adelgid, and then the pine woolly adelgid. They don't feed on anything else. Even giving them choices or no choices, they do these experiments where they'll actually put the beetle in a petri dish, put other things in there, and that's the only thing they have to eat. They don't eat it. They only feed on adelgid. So the 40 years of research has narrowed it down to these 3 to 4 species that are extremely safe to release. There's about 8, actually, but we're focusing on 4.
Yeah, and they have a very strong preference for hemlock woolly adelgid. If they had a preference between balsam woolly adelgid or pine adelgid, they would feed on the hemlock woolly adelgid. They prefer the HWA.
So as a biocontrol agent, these things are safe.
Okay.
And I hear the hesitance in your voice. Yeah, no, I hear your hesitance in your voice. And that somebody mentioned, are you getting any pushback from the chemicals? No. Are we getting any pushback for biocontrol? Yes. And it's not so much a pushback, but there's always that, okay, I really like my hemlocks, but I'm a little leery that you're introducing something into the environment. But these have been, as I say, researched to death. But they are extremely species specific. They don't branch out.
Yeah, I guess I'm just going to mention, Jeff, that there's lots of success stories when it comes to biological or biocontrol. You know, European spruce sawfly found its way into Atlantic Canada. And eventually there was a disease that found its way into the population, which was it's a biological control. It's a disease that got into the population. And it basically knocked populations back. So we didn't see the levels of damage that, we at first were experiencing. There's lots of examples of biocontrol or biological control in agriculture. Gypsy moth, there's nuclear polyhidrosis virus. There's a disease that, will impact gypsy moth. So, these predators and parasites and diseases are actually natural controls that are out there that help to regulate populations so they don't get to damaging levels. So, in Asia and on the west coast of Canada and the Pacific Northwest, U.S., that's that these predators evolved with HWA there and helped to regulate populations there. So we're just kind of looking at doing the same thing here. If you get enough of these predators established here and they're only attacking HWA, then they'll help to regulate the populations here and they'll move naturally through the landscape. They don't care if it's in Lunenburg or if it's, on Crown land, whether it's on private land. But wherever they find HWA life stages, they'll prey on them, and they'll have to regulate populations and prevent damage on hemlock.
Okay, Jeffrey, you can continue.
Yeah, and please ask questions. I see we're long-winded here. just wanted to add that we're also continuing to monitor the population of HWA. Annually, I'm looking at the health of the population on 8 to 10 sites. We studied the biology of it. It's important to know the biology of it. And when each, you know, when are crawlers in the environment? It was done. The research was done in Carolina. The research was done in New York State. But we also did it here to find it, so we can release these predators at the proper time. We don't want to be releasing them when their food's not there. We also need to know for regulatory purposes, when are the crawlers out there? When is the risk? When is the highest risk of spreading this thing? So we continue to work with our partners to monitor these populations. I'm also looking at winter mortality, and we're going to start to look into some biodiversity work within these stands, because we're all concerned about the impact of the loss of these hemlocks. But we, in some cases, we don't know what the base level populations of other insects are in those stands, or what other our species are in those ecosystems that we're going to lose. So we need to continue that type of work. And the last slide.
I'll just, thanks. But in one more time, I think, Councillor DeLong.
I'm sorry, I've already asked a few questions, but
keep asking. Okay, I'm here all day.
Very briefly. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency on their website indicates that they're searching for hemlock woolly adelgid biocontrol agents and developing tools to detect and quantify predatory fly populations. Does that pertain at all to your project, or is that separate from what Nova Scotia is doing?
No, they're part and parcel of the work we are doing for looking for native predators and parasites earlier. So that's like that. I'm guessing that's what they're talking about. They are also the regulatory group that if we're going to bring something in from the States, for example, or if we had another pest and there was predators from Japan, we have to go through the Canadian Food Inspection Agency.
Thank you.
Yeah. The last thing, and one of the most important parts, is the outreach. What we're doing here today, getting the information out there. Because if people don't know about it, they're not going to be looking for it. They're not going to detect it early, and then they're not going to have an opportunity to protect their trees. We have information sessions that are conducted by ourselves, NRR, as well as our partners within the Hemlock Woolly Adelgid Working Group. These include Parks Canada, Medway Forest Co-op, Canadian Forestry Service, and their scientists are key to this. They're the experts. We rely on their science as we move forward. We are helping with that. We're doing our own research, but they're the key folks. And we want to increase the awareness of the threats. Oh, well, it's hemlock. You don't really have to push that hemlock or something to protect. Even though they don't have a huge monetary value, like for timber or what have you, everybody loves a hemlock tree. So getting people to work on this tree or be concerned about it has not been an issue. We're also providing, not we, but I think it's Medway Forest Co-op, Community Forest Co-op. They're going to be conducting field days for landowners and people that are interested in treating their own properties. They will be demos on what products to use, what equipment to buy, what you need, like Dan mentioned, your pesticide applicator's license, that is a necessity. You need that before you can treat your trees. More we can get out there, the better. The more people know about this, the better opportunity we have to actually protect the forest. Dan?
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, you're good.
That is it. The last slide, that's not going to work. Push the wrong button. Are just some of the products that we have and the cost that Dan was speaking of earlier. You can mull over that.
Okay, do we have any questions comments? I think we went through the questions for sure.
Sorry, I was long-winded. I warned you.
Very interesting. Very interesting learning curve for myself, for sure. So if we don't have any other questions, well, thank you for the presentation.
If you have in here, I'm going to go back one slide.
I'm just going to mention while Jeff is doing that if you have any questions that you think of after this presentation, certainly feel free to reach out to either Jeff or myself. and we will do our best to answer your questions. So,
We do have one question. Mayor Balaver-Getson.
I guess, has the department partnered with municipalities in their parks, in municipal parks, to assist them at all? Because municipalities don't have the expertise, most of them, in this line of work.
You're the first municipality we spoke to.
But you have done work with
so
other
we're number one in line then, correct? So I guess if this was found in our parks and we reached out, would there be assistance from DNR? Or natural resources?
For outreach, I say yes. Monetary stuff, I'd leave that to Dan, but I don't believe there's a program at this point.
Okay, thank you.
And I just want to mention, too, that it's not that we haven't been involved with other municipalities. I know Jeff has worked with the town of Truro. He's also, had discussions with folks from HRM. So it's not that we haven't had any type of outreach with the other municipalities. There definitely has been some work with other municipalities as well. Now, we haven't done a formal presentation like we have today, but we have been in contact with them and assisted them on a couple of occasions around the questions I have around HWA.
Okay. Any other questions?
One thing I did offer for Colchester County, sorry to interrupt, one thing I did offer for Colchester County, so yeah, you're number two. I did talk to Colchester. If in the spring or whenever, if you have park staff, if you have public works folks, if you want them to be trained on how to look for hemlock woolly adelgid in your parks, in your street trees, wherever, we'd be happy to go down and put on a little demo.
That's great.
Excellent.
For what to look at. Yeah. Just contact me with that email, and we will, between myself, CFIA, they also provide that as well. We often tag team and discuss that with other people. Oh, and we did something in Kentville as well. So maybe you're third.
Third. Well, that's a great offer. Perfect. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation.
Okay. Everybody have a good day.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we are going to move down. I think we are at 10.2, request for a letter to Nova Scotia Department of Public Works regarding public safety measures, and this is Councillor Oichel.
Thank you very much. I had mentioned and talked a little bit about this at our council meeting last week, and I'll just kind of review with you. Many culverts were not functioning during the July flood and the Fancy Lake area in Hebbville due to their size, damage, or they were full of debris. In some places, to me, new culverts needed to be placed to assist the water flow to go under the road rather than over it. Ditches needed to be cleared of constructive vegetation. Some present culverts needed to be replaced due to the damage or insufficient size. And this will help with the flow of water away from the roads so that residents and emergency vehicles can drive safely. At our last council meeting, we agreed as part of our recommended steps was to create a contingency plan specifically for this area. I feel that having upgrades to culverts and clearing of ditches will greatly assist in the removal of water off the roads and encourage it to flow into the lake and onto the river and into the ocean. This will hopefully assist with keeping the roads clear for residents to exit and for emergency vehicles to assist residents in the area during a major rain event. I realize that as a municipality, we are not responsible for the maintenance of the roads that I'm referring to. I would like to request that the Policy and Strategy Committee recommend to Council to direct the Mayor to write a letter asking DPW to clear out the ditches, upgrade culverts, and consider placing new culverts in specific areas so that the water does not continue to flow over the road. I would also like to discuss a possibility of also asking residents who live on private roads to also consider that ditches and culverts on their roads. I know that we have no authority on private roads, but we could encourage them through communication via mail, road associations, an article in the Municipal Matters, or any other form of communication that would get the message out to assist residents in being more self-reliant and more proactive.
Are you prepared to put the motion on the floor?
I am. I'd like to recommend to the chair and members of the Policy and Strategy Committee, I move that the Policy and Strategy Committee recommend to Council that Municipal Council direct the Mayor to write to the Provincial Minister responsible for Public Works, Kim Masland, and copy the local MLAs requesting the clearing of ditches and replacement of oversized and damaged culverts and the addition of new culverts, specifically where the land topography creates excessive water over roads during storm events, including but not limited to the Fancy Lake area, and I so move.
I believe that that's the replacement of undersized and
damaged
culverts.
Oh, sorry, what did I say?
Oversized.
Oh, undersized, sorry, right. Thank okay. you. Yes, I definitely undersized.
Okay, and seconded by Councillor Moore. Is there discussion on the motion? All those in favor? Councillor Statton?
Yes.
Motion's passed unanimously. So we have an added item, 11.1, internal transportation update, and that would be Councillor Haysom.
Thank you so much, Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to give you a little update from our last internal transportation meeting, and really what we got at this meeting was an update from Lunenburg County Wheels. And as you may know, they have expanded their door-to-door service, so they're now covering almost 80% of the municipality. They're still working on covering that area around Mahone Bay, Lunenburg, Riverport, and that is going to be their next expansion area. Basically, the reason for that delay is they're waiting on a number of their four additional vehicles. Once they have those on the road, they are going to be covering essentially the whole municipality. So this is excellent. There's a lot of volunteers that are involved. There's paid drivers as well. A lot of support from different parts of the community. Just over the weekend, I believe that the Lions Club also made a financial donation to Lunenburg County Wheels, and of course we as a municipality are supporting them as well. A lot of support actually over the summer with the free rides. So there were free rides offered, especially as they were trying to get the expansion areas up and running and try to get the word out. I think that the biggest thing that we as a municipality could do to support them is to, yell far and wide. It's not just for seniors. It used to be, seniors wheels. It's Lunenburg County Wheels. It is available to everyone. I think you have to be 16 or over, or if you're under 16, you have to be with an adult. But I've used the service when I needed a little lift just because my car was in the shop. It was really handy. It was really easy. And it is quite affordable, especially when you compare it to some costs for taxis or other things, which often aren't available depending on the time of day. So I think that they're doing really good work. They do need, I think, some more promotion. And if we as members of council are able to kind of spread that word either through community groups in our area to say, if you need a ride, there is a service that is available to you. But that was just a quick update that I wanted to give you from internal transportation.
It might be something that we can put in our municipal matters, too. Just
absolutely.
Like you said, far and wide, it is for everyone.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Because we want this service to be established, obviously, and I know that it takes a while for people to learn about a service and mm-hmm. to know they can rely on it. But once we start to get that uptake, I think it's going to be really important. So
yeah,
thank you.
For sure. Okay. So the in-camera item is cancelled. Looking for a motion to adjourn. Councillor Wynat, seconded by Councillor Bell. All those in favor? Councillor Statton?
Yes.
Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.